at the time that you started working in computer music, most computer usage was for purposes like accounting and ballistics calculations. What made you even think of using computers as a creative tool?
I had come to Stanford in 1962 from 3 years studying in Paris with Nadia Boulanger, who was a well-known teacher, and people such as Aaron Copland and Quincy Jones and I were there at the same time studying. So she was an important figure in Paris, musical circles, but as important to my own education as Nadia Boulanger was the musical scene in general in Paris. Pierre Boulez was a young avant-garde enfant terrible, often referred to in such a way, in Paris, and had a series of concerts, the Domaine Musical, in which he presented new music, much of which had to do with loudspeakers, electronic music, made by the various kinds of devices that one found in radio studios broadcasting in those days, oscillators, filters, things that could be turned to musical uses by composers if given the opportunity to work in some of these studios. So when I came to Stanford, having had this rich experience in Europe, as a graduate student, I asked if there were possibilities for such, and there were none. There was no studio. There was for electronic music. The only one that I knew of in this country was at Columbia at that time. In any case, my second year of graduate school, my graduate studies with Leland Smith in composition, not musicology, as is noted in the book, but rather I'm a composer by training. I was given an article that Max Matthews had written. Max was a researcher at Bell Labs, director of the Behavioral Research Lab, and his interests not only were engineering and engineering sciences, but also music, and he had developed a program which allowed computers to be used to generate acoustic signals. This, of course, was of interest in the scientific community for speech research, but Max's interests were in music, and he wrote this article published in Science in November 1963 describing this program. So that was the beginning.
Now, in the very beginning of electronic music, the electronics we're talking about were actually analog. By the timing of your start in the electronic music field, you managed to get in on the ground floor of digital electronic music. In the very beginning, access to computers must have been a very big problem.
Well, it was. But Stanford had a kind of open view toward this and had made an invitation to the School of Humanities to look at computers and possible applications. So there was a coincidence that was my good fortune, that is, having looked at this article by Max, also realizing that the computer science department, which was then part of the School of Humanities and Sciences, was open to uses other than the sort of applications which you described at the outset. So I met a young undergraduate, David Poole, who was a tuba player in the orchestra, Stanford Orchestra. I was the timpanist at the time, a 30-year-old graduate student. David was probably a 19 or 20-year-old undergraduate. He saw me at the computer center one day holding a big box of IBM cards, which I had acquired from Max at Bell Labs, and asked what I was doing, and I told him that I was going to try and implement this program on the computer system at Stanford, and he jumped in and offered to help me. I think without David, I may not have been successful in these early years because it was laborious, it was difficult. One had to have fairly comprehensive understanding of how computers work. My last math course had been in high school, so it was a long way for me to, let's say, would have been a bit of a stretch for me to have tried to have accomplished this all by myself. So David taught me basically all that I needed to know. over the course of several years. He got the program going, taught me how to program, taught me the basics of acoustics, all the things that I needed to understand in order to begin work with the computer. Now, it turns out that his solution to getting continuous data stream of samples from a big IBM 7090 to a digital analog converter, which was actually the two ladders, the XY coordinates of a DEX scope. This continuous data stream, in order not to have small segments of sound, but rather continuous sound, turned out to be a solution to increasing the number of timeshare users on this PDP-1 DEC timesharing system, which I think supported two or three users, and David's solution to the problem of data bandwidth and continuous samples also solved their problem for fast swapping. And as I remember, the number of users after he did that went from two or three to eight or 10, something of that sort. So he became a very important part of the Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. He finished his graduate work and then went on and did some, finished his undergraduate, I'm sorry, then did some graduate work, but he basically became a kind of the system guru of the lab that John McCarthy directed in the early years.
When you came to Stanford then, you did not immediately go to the AI lab. That was subsequent in your career. When did you go from the regular campus to the AI lab? And given that you were a professor of music at that point, rather than a professor of math or computer science, what motivated you to move out there?
I was a graduate student, actually, until 1966, when I finished my doctorate. But the initial work was done at the computer center on campus on a PDP-1, which shared a 2314 disk with an IBM 7090. And in 1966 is when the AI project acquired a PDP-6, which was a large machine, time-shared, and moved to the DC Power Laboratory on Arastradero Road. And it was then that I started teaching as well that year.
Your move to the SAIL facility then out on Arastradero Road was motivated in large part by your desire to have access to the computing resources there. Did you have a lot of contact with the faculty who were doing the more hardcore computer science research, like robotics or formal proofs of computer programs?
Yes, I did. I mean, it was one community of people, some having more stature than others, I'd say. I was not funded, and the work that I did, and also with Leland Smith, who joined me in this work, who had been my composition professor, now then in 1966, a colleague, senior colleague, we were unsupported, so therefore we were constrained in the hours in which we could use the system, to weekends and nights, and I would say some very late nights. But there was one researcher, Raj Reddy, who went on to Carnegie Mellon, and I think director of their robotics lab, who at that time was working in speech recognition. And he and I, of course, had some common interest in that we were both interested in the acoustic domain. So that was a rich connection. I must say I used the body of people at the AI lab to my own advantage. I was able to ask many people many questions and get good solid answers about things that were common knowledge to those who were educated in the sciences. And so it was a very rich environment from my point of view. I think of all the people, probably David Poole was the most important, but in my own particular work, because he wrote a special compiler that was native to the PDP-6, PDP-10 family of computers. And in doing that, he taught me programming in assembly language, whatnot, and sort of shepherded me through the life at the AI lab, protecting me from occasionally arrogant scientists who would have liked less competition for compute cycles, but in general, it was a pretty nice environment and supportive, I would say.